Thanks for a terrific introduction. Introductions are very important. I was once prepared to go on television in Chicago, and someone came around with that list of the day's guests and looked at my name and said, "Are you Lloyd or Lloyd?" It was only later I found out that very person was a big fan of Michelle Pfeiffer. Before I go on, I'd just like to say that what you heard earlier, I'm a magna cum laude graduate of the 60s, and it's not often I can hear a talk about the 60s and sit there nodding in agreement with virtually everything, so you got the good stuff. As for the drug aspect of it, it was that bad and worse. The sort of creed was, give me Librium or give me meth. That's sort of a one-sentence summation of the whole decade. I've been billed to speak to you about what's left of the party in Hollywood. It's an interesting question. It's a neglected question. We should start out by establishing what party we're talking about. It's not the post-Oscar party or the post-Emmy party or the Democratic Republican party. It's the Communist Party. This is a group that had considerable cultural influence in the United States, much more than most people recognize. That was, of course, what I attempted to outline in my book. Communists, especially the pioneers, were fascinated with the moving image because it allowed endless alteration of reality, which, of course, was the very thing they were trying to do in actual life. But rather than founding their own commercial cinema, they set out to co-opt the one that already existed here in California. They had a very good plan, very bold plan. It came very close to success. But it left a legacy that you can still see virtually every day on the big screen and the small screen. But first, you need to get what Hollywood calls the back story. During the 30s and 40s, the Communist Party in this town, it wasn't just another caucus. It was rather the only game in town, as Bud Schulberg said. He was the former party member, author of the novel What Makes Sammy Run, screenwriter for On the Waterfront. And it was his view that they really ran the politics in this town. And he's not alone in that view. Screenwriter and director Philip Dunn, he directed Last of the Mohicans and other movies. He put it best. He said, "All over town, the industrious communist tail wagged the lazy liberal dog." The party, they were brilliant at organizing front groups. These are groups that they controlled without that control being recognized. The major one was the Hollywood Anti-Nazi League. There were many of them. Another was the Hollywood Independent Citizens Council for the Arts, Sciences, and Professions, also known as HICASP. The party used these groups brilliantly to co-opt wealthy industry liberals. The very people they regarded as, quote, political morons and so many fat cows to be milked. And that was really their main purpose in coming to town, was to raise money, and they raised a lot of it. Of course, part of their purpose was to use these groups for their own causes, the Spanish Civil War, denying Stalinist atrocities, that sort of thing. Some of these groups, of course, had a very hard time during periods like the Nazi-Soviet Pact. A fellow named Walter Bernstein, he's the screenwriter for the Woody Allen movie, The Front. He also wrote Failsafe and Semi-Tough, former party member. He said the party had its own sly arithmetic and could make two seem to be one. Sort of the communists and liberals, one in the spirit. Bernstein, by the way, his name appears in the Soviet cable traffic, the Venona intercepts. And I was thinking, this gives new meaning to the phrase, have your agent call my agent. Apparently that actually happened. The Communist Party, you might be interested to know, actually founded entire show business unions. Some of these were the Story Analysts Guild, the Publicists Guild, and the Cartoonists. The police raided the home of a party activist named Jeff Kyber and found a bunch of his correspondence. And he talked about the cartoonist union was organized by us. And that explains a lot of the antipathy toward Walt Disney, who resisted their organizing efforts. They dominated many other backlot unions, including the publicists. And their plan was kind of a two-pronged affair, the one through the backlot technical unions and the other in the so-called talent guilds. And they were strongest there among the writers. The first president of the Screenwriters Guild, John Howard Lawson, was the party's enforcer and a Stalinist thug of considerable ferocity. A gentleman named Leopold Atlas, he was the screenwriter for G.I. Joe and other films, he testified that he was afraid to leave the party because they were strategically positioned throughout the industry, and to leave the party would have amounted to professional suicide, and he was right. Now, besides raising tons of money and co-opting liberals to their causes, the party wanted to influence the content of movies. They knew this would be difficult under the studio system, which was kind of an absolute monarchy, where the studio bosses had complete control. But they got some breaks during World War II, when the party was, in effect, given a leave of absence to be patriotic. They authored a number of movies, notable among them North Star, Song of Russia, and Mission to Moscow, which some dubbed, for good reason, Submission to Moscow. I mean, it was one thing to say that we were fighting with the Soviet Union to defeat Hitler. It was another thing to say that the Soviet Union was this wonderful place full of happy workers, bringing, and was the wave of the future, the workers' paradise, and so on. After the war, the party changed its line again, and what makes this story so messy is they switched overnight. You had to be a party member, you had to instantly condemn what had previously been approved, and instantly approve what had previously been condemned, and that requires a very special kind of person. But they launched an effort to form one huge union in Hollywood, which they would control. And if they were able to do this, then perhaps they could leverage more content in the movies. At that time, this was literally war in the streets, and you can get the whole blow-by-blow account in my book. At this time, the party blacklisted actors who failed to fall in line with their labor group. It was at this time that a labor leader named Ronald Reagan discovered what communism was really about. And for a time, he actually supported the party-backed group, which was called the Conference of Studio Unions. When he came back from war, he was the backer of that group and its leader, a guy named Herb Sorrell. But he very quickly learned what this was about, because the actors crossed the picket lines, because it was not an economic strike, it was a jurisdictional dispute. And when they attempted to go to work, communist thugs would beat them up in the streets, throw coffee in their faces, throw tacks in front of their automobiles, that sort of thing. So that was Mr. Reagan's school of communism. Of course, it wasn't just another party at any time, the Communist Party. It was an instrument of Soviet colonialism. It was a spy ring. It was a terrorist organization. And as anyone who experienced the wrath will tell you, the Communist Party of the United States was also a hate group. This is the thing you know the most. These people, absolutely sulfuric haters of the United States, just prodigious haters. And this worked against them. They really alienated the actors and some parts of the media, which could have helped them. And then, of course, came the hearings, the House Committee on Un-American Activities, of which Senator McCarthy had absolutely no part. Virtually all these battles were fought before he even appeared on the scene, and most of them were fought by liberal Democrats and New Dealers, not conservatives. What really killed them was their loyalty to Stalin. That is the defining feature of American communism, is its loyalty to Stalin. And when Khrushchev came out with his speech in 56, that really killed the party in Hollywood as a party. Unfortunately, the story does not end there. And the legacy of those days is still very much with us. The militant, disciplined branch of the party became a kind of rump group. You had figures like Dalton Trumbo, Al Lubezki, Michael Wilson, and others making a good living in the black market. And that the 60s really changed their fortunes. And from then on, they would be trotted out every so often like trained SEALs and given illustrious awards accompanied by sonorous speeches about the dark days of the blacklist. And this still goes on. It's kind of a cottage industry here in town. The party organization gradually gave way to what we have now, which I'm going to call the Cabbage Patch Left. For this group, political correctness is a kind of Stalinism light. Like its party ancestors, this group believes that America is a villain and capitalism is evil, except for my three-picture deal with Warner Brothers, except for my Malibu mansion, except for my Mercedes-Benz. That is very good. All the rest of it is bad. Call it dialectical commercialism. From each according to his naivete, to each according to his greed. You might look at a guy like, say, Alec Baldwin. This is a group that confuses having a lot of money and power with having a lot to say. And they're not the same thing. In many cases, people in the Cabbage Patch Left, of course, fabulously wealthy. But like the party people of old, they regard themselves as proletarian wage slaves, literary workers toiling for bourgeois businessmen like Rupert Murdoch, and maybe even Ted Turner, oddly enough. The key here is to accumulate as much wealth as you can without being perceived to be wealthy. Just like Stalin wanted to purge millions of people, but he didn't want to be seen as cruel. It's the same kind of dynamic. And let's remember what kind of community we're dealing with here. Recently, actor Nick Nolte revealed, he was one of those who, by the way, refused to stand when they gave the Oscar to Aaliyah Kazan. Mr. Nolte regularly extracts his own blood, breathes ozone from an oxygen tank, stands in urine, and injects strange identified vitamin and hormone cocktails until he nearly loses consciousness. Or consider Barbara Streisand, recently asked about Hillary Clinton's Senate run. "Well, I think she's great. I mean, she has great ideas, you know. She's a Democrat, and why not? I mean, why not Hillary? She's a fighter, you know. She's eloquent. I've never seen anybody talk without notes like she does. Have you ever seen her talk? She's amazing." The line on popular culture, particularly television, used to be based on the famous Newton Minow phrase, "It was a vast wasteland." And it came to be known as the force that made America stupid. And Neil Postman wrote a very thoughtful book about that called Amusing Ourselves to Death. And in his review of that book, Terry Teachout entertained a different thesis. Yes, TV is, say, popular culture in general, is the force that made America stupid. But it's also the force that made America's stupid people powerful. So that's another dynamic that's going on. And in this community, both bizarre behavior and leftist politics are actually rewarded. It's the same dynamic that Midge spoke about earlier. There's no penalty for this. Consider the Jane Fonda episodes. She chose to become a sort of Axis Sally for the Viet Cong, and her career suffered not in the slightest. Then, of course, the Hollywood left became a vocal lobby for the nuclear freeze movement, which was a direct gambit of Soviet propaganda. The communist guerrillas in El Salvador, they became a cause celeb here with Ed Asner, Mike Farrell, and others leading the charge. Nicaraguan comandante Daniel Ortega, loathsome and not particularly intelligent man, even by Marxist standards. He got the red carpet treatment in town. But consider this, during the entire Cold War, not a single Eastern European dissident ever became a cause celeb in this town, not one. And this is true even though some of these people, say Václav Havel, he was an artist, he was a playwright. This also is a direct legacy of the Communist Party. As George Orwell learned, if you criticized the Soviet Union, you were attacked as playing into the hands of their Nazi opponents. If you take up causes like Eastern European dissidents in this town, you are in effect saying, McCarthy was right, the committee was right, So those are off limits. This is a town dominated by anti-communist. I'm sure the old party hacks still around are pleased by this, and they have to be even more pleased by movie and TV content. Although the party knew they couldn't inject much content into the movies, they were very good at quashing things they didn't like. Their position in unions, like the Story Analysts Guild, they were what you would call now a reader. So you'd get a script, maybe it's a good script, but it sort of has some anti-communist, well, you roundfile it right away. Communist agents like George Woolner sold out their own clients, refused to sell their work. Dalton Trumbo bragged openly that Arthur Koestler's Darkness at Noon and other anti-communist classics had not been made into movies. So their legacy is more a question of what we don't have. Now, we have scores of films, some of them very good, about a German National Socialist regime that existed for 12 years and passed out of existence in 1945, 54 years ago. Very few films have been made about a Soviet communist regime that lasted from 1917 to 1991. The Moscow trials, the Ukraine famine, the Gulag, the Katyn Forest murders, the Doctor's Plot, the Hungarian Revolution, Prague Spring, dramatic escapes from East Germany, from Cuba, and so on, persecution of writers. All those are, for the most part, cinematically unexplored. We just don't have those films. On the other hand, we do have sort of anti-nuclear pornography like The Day After, dreary left-wing movies like Daniel and Testament, which were produced even though they were money losers, which shows you how strong this animus is in Hollywood. One movie was made about escape from East Berlin. It was by Disney. It was called Night Crossing. But that issue isn't understood. I recall when the wall came down, there was a CNN story. All these jubilant Germans out celebrating, and the CNN reporter looked into the camera and said, "They are commemorating a time when it was less easy to cross the wall." It was a party's superstition that since communism wasn't a threat, American anti-communism had to be based on something else, xenophobia, or in a more sinister fashion. It was the result of old Nazis coming into the country after World War II. That's where American anti-communism came from. And you see this in many movies. The House on Carroll Street, which is written by Walter Bernstein. Or Marathon Man, where you see them collaborating with the Vatican and the CIA. I think as Joe Sobran put it best, that a few dozen octogenarian Nazis living in Paraguay can have so much influence, let's give it to them. They are the master race. On the party blacklist were not just anti-communist, anti-Soviet stories, but positive portrayals of businessmen. They hated businessmen. They wouldn't allow anything to go on that showed them in a favorable light. Also, the same with religious believers. And now these bigotries are very strong still in this town, particularly among the writers. And they share that old party creed that art is a weapon. The writer is he's an artist in uniform. Dalton Trumbo said that the writer is conducting literary guerrilla warfare. In this creed, dramatic art has to send a political message, otherwise it's just so much bourgeois decadence. And this was, as you'll see in my book, this was a creed that was actually enforced. And Albert Maltz wrote this, which I thought was a pretty good article denouncing this, and was put through several sessions of brainwashing and made to write another article disclaiming his previous article and to publicly renounce his stand. It's absolutely amazing stuff. And you could point to it whenever you're told, as you will be, that these were noble idealists of work. Maltz, by the way, became an admirer of East Germany. That's the country that murdered people for attempting to emigrate. Lester Cole, another Hollywood 10 member, he became an admirer of North Korea. The Cabbage Patch left, on the other hand, don't really have any Stalinist regimes to admire. But there's still aspects of their mindset that gets the most screen time. In the 30s, the party had a slogan. It was very effective. It's smart to be a Red. Another one proposed was Ring Lardner. The most beautiful girls in Hollywood belong to the Communist Party. Which was really kind of a lonely hearts club here in town. That's why they were very effective recruiters. But you still see this variations of this, it's smart to be a Red. To be on the left is to be intellectual and enlightened. To be on the right is to be stupid and dangerous. I came across this, I was watching You've Got Mail. I find these ritualistic put-downs of conservatives, whereas there's a liberal columnist played by Greg Kinnear, and everyone's telling him how brilliant he is. And of course he's an expert on the Rosenbergs, who of course are innocent. More recently, Arlington Road. Fascinating, fascinating. There's a terrorist based on the Oklahoma City bomber, and people are explaining, well, we're puzzled by this. I mean, he was thought to be only a moderate conservative. So that's the sort of mindset that you get. A major villain, however, is conservative Christianity. This is public enemy number one in this town. This, of course, started with All in the Family, in which Meathead, played by Rob Reiner, became a kind of evangelist for Noam Chomsky. And Archie Bunker became the ultimate straw man. I challenge you to try watching this show now. It really shouts through a bullhorn. Reiner went on to produce The American President, written by Aaron Sorkin, kind of a long op-ed piece full of environmental homilies and so on, a whole litany of liberal democratic causes. The war on drugs would be easier to fight if we weren't arming drug dealers, huffs the Stephanopoulos character played on Michael J. Fox. And Richard Dreyfuss, looking more like Mel Brooks, plays this bombastic, moralistic Kansas Republican. This is now on the small screen, also written by Aaron Sorkin, in the form of West Wing. You simply must watch this. Amazing stuff. Mr. Sorkin, whom I don't know, he said, maybe we'll be excited to look at the White House the way we wish it was. In any case, there's a group of religious right types that has complete power, instant access to the president, and they're utterly vilified. The leader looks like a kind of retarded Colonel Sanders. And his colleague Mary, note the name, is kind of cross-eyed and menacing, like a sort of escaped mental patient in an Alfred Hitchcock movie. And they demand that the president denounce abortion in his speech, and he won't do it. And then he tells them, I'm not making this up. He says, now you can get your fat asses out of my White House. Now I'm waiting for the episode where he tells them, where he addresses the leader of the Nation of Islam, where one character told the religious right type, the God you pray to is too busy getting indicted for tax fraud. But we'll see what happens there. The critics love the show. They criticized that the president's cabinet was all white, which, of course, was the only accurate part of it. The producers of the show claim that it's all, of course, simply entertainment. And I really think this is the wave of the future, this sort of agitprop drama on the small screen, that you're going to see more and more of this. I haven't read the article in Reason. I will with great interest. Yeah, PBS and NPR are sort of the documentary wing of the left wing of the Democratic Party. Now, network television will become its dramatic wing, the sort of arts and entertainment of the left. But maybe it's not all bleak. Maybe we'll catch a break. Maybe these millionaire writers are telling the truth. They're just doing their job as entertainers. Maybe someday West Wing will have a Tootsie episode. Maybe Martin Sheen will music up with a swell. He'll look into the camera, he'll pull off his mask, and he'll be Barbara Streisand. And then we can cut to a deadpan Bill Murray for a curtain call. Now that is one crazy White House.